You are listening to the Mob Files Podcast, a podcast about the history of the Italian-American Mafia and other influential organized crime groups in North America. If you enjoy today's episode, be sure to subscribe or follow. New episodes come out on Thursday evenings. Hello everyone and welcome back to the Mob Files. I'm your host Brian McCoy, coming to you from beautiful Tampa, Florida. Well, at least usually it's actually been storming all day today. I hope everyone had a good and safe 4th of July holiday. Today is going to be part 2 of our Mob Hit series, where we are covering various mafia killings. We're going to cover 3 different hits today. Our first hit for part 2 is Albert Anastasia, whose murder is one of the most infamous killings in mob history that occurred in New York City. Our second hit is the murder of Danny the Irishman Green, who, as you can probably gather from the nickname, was an Irish gangster who operated in the Cleveland area. And lastly, we're going to talk about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which was the murder of 7 Irish gangsters in Chicago during the Prohibition era. So as I said, the first hit we're going to cover today is Albert Anastasia. Anastasia became one of the most feared mobsters in history due to his brutality. He even earned nicknames such as Mad Hatter and Lord High Executioner. How does someone become such a monster so as to earn those types of nicknames? Well, I'm not sure we can adequately explain that without the help of a psychologist, but we'll go ahead and start with some background information on Anastasia. He was born on September 26, 1902 in Calabria, Italy. When he was still a teenager in 1919, he left the ship he was working on and entered New York City. Anastasia's life was almost cut very short. He was convicted of murder in 1921 and was sentenced to death. However, he was able to obtain a new trial and he was acquitted during that one. Over the next decade or so, Anastasia was charged with several more murders, but he was able to escape conviction on all of those. In the 30s, Anastasia became the leader of Murder Incorporated, the famous hit squad in New York City. I've talked about them in several episodes before, but they were the enforcement wing of the mob, and they also did some work on behalf of the Jewish mob as well. It was largely because of his work with that group that Anastasia became something of a legend. And I don't say legend in a positive manner. The reason he gained that status is because of, like I said before, his brutality and just the sheer number of murders committed by him and Murder Inc. as a whole. It's estimated that they were responsible for more than 100 killings in about a decade's time. The group did end up dissolving in the early 40s after law enforcement struck several major blows against them, and Anastasia was able to escape the worst of that, and he continued to climb up the ranks of the mob world. And as he did so, he was working under and as part of the organization of Vincent Manganos. The two men apparently did not like each other. Mangano was, and I've discussed this divide before in other episodes, Mangano was an old school boss. He believed strongly in the traditions that had guided the organization throughout its history and didn't want to deviate from that. Whereas Anastasia was part of that newer breed that was willing to not ignore, but maybe bend the rules of tradition a little bit to try to advance the agenda of the organization. And also, Mangano thought that Anastasia got out over his skis too often, working with other mobsters and groups without Mangano's permission. The thing is, though, people who had disagreements with Anastasia had a weird habit of ending up on the wrong side of the ground. Mangano was no exception despite being a boss. He went missing in April 1951, and his body was never found. His brother's body was found on that same day. So law enforcement never linked Anastasia to the crime, but I mean, it seems pretty obvious what happened. Anastasia wanted to keep rising up the ranks, and there was a very clear obstacle to him doing so, and so he took care of it. The Mafia Commission was obviously curious about what had happened, about a boss being killed, and it was somewhat the general consensus that Anastasia was responsible, but despite all that, they eventually okayed him becoming the new boss of the family. And just for reference, this family would end up becoming the Gambino family, and you'll hear a little bit about that in just a minute. Now, as we get closer to Anastasia's murder, it's important to understand the overall vibe of the mafia in New York City at that time. Vito Genovese was actively making a strong push for expanded power in the city. His main target in this push was Frank Costello. Costello and Anastasia were allies, and so Anastasia became a target by association. Genevieve started to rally support for his plans to take out Anastasia, and he had a lot of ammo for this. Anastasia's brutality was not respected by everybody, and that makes sense. Anastasia's antics were the type that could bring increased heat on an organization. There are plenty of stories of the mob exercising caution in an effort to stay off of law enforcement's radar. There's no way to get the police on your backs faster than a lot of bodies showing up in your territory. The most important green light that Genovese got was from Carlo Gambino, who was Anastasia's underboss and sold him out. On October 25th, 1957, Anastasia went to the Park Sheraton Hotel in Manhattan to get a haircut. Two men entered the barbershop with their faces covered and opened fire. Anastasia apparently tried to lunge at the shooters, but was disoriented by his injuries and was actually lunging at their reflections in the mirror in front of him. He was 55 years old. Anastasia's murder led to one of the most iconic images in the history of the mob. The images of Anastasia laying on the barbershop floor covered in towels immediately after the shooting had occurred. Carlo Gambino was rewarded for his role in the killing and was named boss of the Mangano family, which of course subsequently became the Gambino crime family. Genovese had largely succeeded in his plan to consolidate power. Anastasia was dead and Costello had been forced into retirement. I know I've described this a couple of times, but there was an attempted hit on Costello and he knew that it wasn't safe for him to stay in power anymore, so he agreed to turn things over to Genovese. However, as I've talked about on a few previous episodes, Genovese's ability to enjoy this newfound power was short-lived. He was largely blamed for the Apalachin meeting debacle in 1957, which led to more than 60 mobsters being arrested. And they didn't just blame him out of nowhere. Genovese was one of the main drivers behind the meeting because he wanted to try to establish himself as a power in New York City and wanted everybody to be aware of that. He wanted things to be official. He was convicted on drug charges in 1959 and ultimately he died in prison. There is speculation that Genovese was set up by several mob members as retaliation for the Apalachin meeting and for rubbing people the wrong way during his quest for more power. Okay, moving on to our second hit here. This is the murder of Danny the Irishman Green in 1977. Green was born in 1933 in Cleveland. After a stint in the military after graduating high school, Green returned to Cleveland and started working as a longshoreman on the docks. He eventually became president of the local International Longshoremen's Association chapter, and he was a powerful union boss in the early 60s and often led protests and strikes to get his point across and make sure that his guys were taken care of. He also was not afraid to use violence or at least threaten it to achieve his goals. Eventually, a reporter caught wind of Green's illegal activities and started to gather evidence. He was subsequently forced out of the union and convicted of embezzlement. Money that was supposed to go towards the union had started ending up in Green's personal accounts instead. And his conviction was actually overturned, but he did plead guilty to lesser charges of falsifying union records. Now, in terms of connections to organized crime, Green was linked to various local mobsters, including Alex Burns, who was a Jewish mobster, and Frank Brancato. But his closest connection was to John Nardi, a heavy-hitting enforcer for the local Italian mafia family. Green also started his own crew consisting of Irishmen, and the crew's main focus was on gambling. Burns and Green had a falling out, and in the mid-70s, there were multiple attempts on Green's life. In one instance, a bomb in Green's car failed to detonate, and in May 1975, a building owned by Green was blown up while he was inside, but he actually managed to walk away with only minor injuries. Green ultimately came out on top in his fight with Burns. In March 1975, Burns was killed in a bombing in a parking lot. It later came out that Green had hired a Hell's Angels crew to take him out. Around this same time, Green started to push in on rackets that were traditionally under the control of the Italians in the city, including vending machines. Obviously, this was going to cause conflict, and things escalated with the death of John Scalise in 1976 of heart failure. Scalise was the boss of the Italian family in Cleveland at that point, and so, as often happens, when he died, power vacuum was created. It was at this point that Green teamed up with Nardi to try to expand their power in the city. Again, they sensed the opportunity that Scalise's death presented to them. and Cleveland became an absolute war zone at this point. Nardi and Green took out multiple high-ranking members of the old guard of the Cleveland family, and the family obviously struck some blows as well. Now, what was somewhat unique about this as compared to other cities was the method that the two sides used, and that method was bombings. The city was actually nicknamed Bomb City, USA during this period just because of how many bombings there were. This included more than 30 bombings in 1976 alone. And the mob didn't sit on its heels during this time. They were actively trying to take out Green and Nardi, but for a long time they failed to do so, but eventually their luck ran out. I mean, when you have a mob family after you, you can only get away for so long. On May 17, 1977, Nardi was killed with a car bomb. On October 6th of that same year, Green arrived for a dentist appointment at a building in Lyndhurst, Ohio. While he was inside, a bomb was planted near his car. Green left the appointment and came back out to his vehicle, and when he got close to it, the bomb was detonated, killing him instantly. He was 43 years old. Two Italian hitmen were arrested for the murder. One of them, Jimmy Fratiano, flipped and cooperated with the federal government. He helped put numerous mob figures behind bars and then entered the Federal Witness Protection Program. Alright, our third and final hit is the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. I talked about this a bit during the Tony Accardo episode, but I didn't go into a ton of detail on it, and it certainly deserves to have a ton of details. Okay, so setting the stage here a bit. Al Capone and the Outfit were at the top of the food chain in Chicago during Prohibition, and it was extremely profitable for them. Obviously, they didn't want this to change, and they would do just about anything to make sure that they stayed on top. While they were obviously the dominant force in the city, that they did have some rivals. And one of these rivals was the Northside Gang, which was an Irish gang. The Northsiders were led by George Bugs Moran, and Moran was turning into a real pain for Capone. The lines of their territory were a little murky, and obviously they didn't always agree on who controlled what. And the fight over bootlegging was really the boiling point of the feud. Now, it would have been one thing if it would have been just disputes over certain pieces of territory in the city, like I said. That could get violent enough, but to make matters even worse, a few of Capone's liquor shipments had been hijacked before they reached Chicago, and Capone suspected that Moran and the Northside Gang were behind it. Eventually, Capone decided that the only course that made sense was to take Moran out. The Outfit knew top-level Northsiders warned to be present at a garage on the north side of the city on the morning of February 14, 1929, hence the name St. Valentine's Day Massacre. A number of the gang members arrived at the garage as planned. Shortly thereafter, the Outfit guy showed up, and four of them entered the garage. And here's where it gets really wild. Two of the shooters were dressed up as and impersonating law enforcement officials, and they ordered the Irishmen to line up against the wall. You know, it's hard to say what would have been going through the Northside gang members' heads at that point. Did they know it was about to happen, or did they truthfully think that these were just police officers coming to investigate them? Either way, the seven Irishmen were lined up against the wall, and then two of the shooters opened fire with machine guns. Amazingly, one of the victims actually survived for a few hours after the shooting, but he refused to say anything about who had shot him. When he was asked about it, he just said, "Nobody shot me." What's crazy is that the prime target, Moran, was not killed in this incident. He had been a bit delayed and then stayed away from the garage after he saw a police cruiser in the area. It's speculated that the Outfit members thought that Moran was present and mistook one of the men there for him, so that's why they proceeded with the shooting. Of course, it's, in my mind at least, it's hard to say that they would have completely turned away from the plan just because their main target wasn't there at that point. It seemed like they had reached the point of no return, but I guess it adds an interesting wrinkle to things. Now, for obvious reasons, Capone was the prime suspect. He had been in a well-known feud with the Northside Gang, so there was motive there. He had a lot to gain from it. Now, Capone wasn't in town when it happened. He was down in Florida, but Again, that doesn't really matter. It's not like Al Capone was going to go over there personally and take care of it anyway. So the general consensus is that he gave the order for it to happen, and then some of his top guys took care of it. Now, law enforcement poked around, but at least initially they weren't really able to link anybody close to Capone to the crime, definitively at least. But there were still consequences for Capone in the outfit. So up until that point, Capone had largely been able to maintain a positive image in the community. He was even seen as something of a Robin Hood. He helped operate and even sometimes personally pitched in at soup kitchens and things like that. But the St. Valentine's Day massacre changed that image. It shattered it. The level of violence and brutality was just too much for people to ignore. Capone became a priority for law enforcement and was named Public Enemy Number 1 by the Chicago Crime Commission. And of course, as everyone knows, it was eventually his failure to pay income taxes that brought him down. He was convicted and sentenced to 11 years in prison in 1931. Alright, that wraps up part 2 of our Mob Hit series. Thank you for listening to The Mob Files. If you enjoyed, be sure to subscribe or follow, and please leave a review on your listening platform of choice. Thanks again, and have a great day.